Hi, I'm Amanda Sewell, live in Studio A here at Interlochen Public Radio. And our guest today is Matthew McAllister. He is a classical guitarist. He serves as tutor and lecturer in music at the University of St. Andrews and the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. Matthew, welcome.
Hi.
And he's giving a recital tonight at 7 o'clock here on the campus of Interlochen at the Dendrinos Chapel and Recital Hall. So, Matthew, you're tracking all over the Western Hemisphere now. You're giving concerts and master classes in the U.S., in Canada, and Europe. What are some things you enjoy about traveling so much?
Well, seeing different people, meeting different people, and being in different places. So they're sort of obvious, I guess. But so when you travel with your instrument, I think sometimes people think because it's music that you do, you're like on holiday, like, you know, or it's like it's just all nice and you see sort of nice things all the time. But I sort of treat it quite like work. You know, so it's my job to go about and to travel and to be abroad and to visit these places. So sort of when I get there, it's like I want to get things done. Like I want to meet the students and I want to teach and I want to sort of help as much as possible. So it's like there's a kind of there's a direction to it all. Do you know what I mean? It's not like by accident or kind of like I'm just going from one place to the next. I'm sort of very much like on a mission. Like,
you're not an itinerant musician of the
past? No, it's not like a wandering minstrel. Like, and I might look like it and sort of sound like it sometimes, but it's kind of got a plan, I think.
So how do you transport your guitar when you fly? Does it get its own seat or do you stow it?
Sometimes it gets its own seat if I'm very lucky and the concert organizers pay me lots of money or they've agreed to put it on a seat. And it's not sometimes that expensive, actually. You know, a lot of airlines like discount the price of a second seat for an instrument. But for sure, I like to sort of have it with me in the cabin all the time. And it's small enough, a guitar, it always fits in the overhead. So I can cry on cue at the check-in desk if needs be, and I can try and be as charming as possible to get the plane to, you know, accept the guitar. That's the main thing.
So here in the US, you can use your charming Scottish accent.
I try. I kind of lay it on thick, do you know what I mean? Like, you know, at the check-in desk, like to just try and get myself just guaranteed that this thing's going to come on board with me.
Well, luckily it made it here with you here at Interlochen. So what's the first piece you're going to play for us today?
Yeah, so I'll play a beautiful piece from a French composer, a man called Roland Dienz, and it's called Song Capricorn. Thank you.
We heard classical guitarist Matthew McAllister live in Studio A here at Interlochen Public Radio, performing Song Capricorn, music of Roland Dienz. Thank you.
No problem. Thanks very much.
So, Matthew, you have a pretty substantial web presence. You have a Facebook feed, a Twitter account, and a pretty good-sized YouTube channel. What role does your online presence play? Do you think of it in terms of promotion or education or something else?
So kind of a bit of everything, I guess. I'm a bit of a geek, actually, I think, if truth be told. And I kind of like all these things. I think they're interesting ways to sort of get your music out there and heard in different ways and seen in different ways. And I mean, like, I have a vinyl record collection. I'm a traditionalist as well. Do you know what I mean? I like all of it, you know, and I don't really, sometimes people have sort of attitudes towards like social media or to like kind of modern day digital sharing of music as it's like, it's a travesty, you know, and you shouldn't do it, you know, but I don't mind how people get the music. As long as they're listening to the music and experiencing it, I'm happy. So, I like to take care of it in the different fields as well as I can and have as much control over it as well so that, like, you know, it doesn't get sort of put out there in a way that I don't like or I'm not proud of and things like that. So I take care over all the different sort of outlets where I can share things. And I think Twitter's great for, like, you know, just sharing things as you tour around and as you go about, experiences that you have and how things really are as well. Like, you know, Facebook's good, but no one really puts anything negative on Facebook. They just put like all the good stuff, you know, that's happening in their life, you know, or how great they are. So sometimes I think it's nice to use the social media to sort of show a bit more of the reality of, like, you know, being a musician and how hard it is, how much you have to work and practice, and also what it's like going from place to place and playing and performing. So I like these things a lot, you know, and I do take care of them because I think they're a great way to get music out there. So.
Yeah, your YouTube channel, there's videos of you performing solo. There's videos of you with chamber groups.
Yep.
You feature your students.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's really important. Like, I mean, that the whole point is it's like a kind of maybe a curation, like a little channel where you can, you know, my friends, colleagues, if they come to Scotland, I try and hook up with them and maybe film them playing something, or if I can get a snippet of their concert or something, or students as well. It's a great way for students to sort of, people can keep their eye on them then as they grow into artists. If they're lucky to become players, then there's a sort of lineage. You can sort of track how they've got there, which is really nice. So, yeah, sort of, I think it's a really fun thing to do.
You have a lot of tutorials on your YouTube page as well.
Yeah.
Not only playing tutorials, but also practical tutorials. So I have to ask, I have to ask about one of those, which is talk to us about the importance of nail care guitarists.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like I have my own salon, you know. No, I mean, I probably have more nail products than, like, you know, like all the female people here in Interlochen. I probably have more nail care stuff than them, you know. My right hand nails are obviously quite long in order to pluck the string, and it's just obviously, you need to get a kind of clear sound on the guitar, and you need to be able to differentiate between all the different strings you're playing and different lines of music. And having nails helps you get that clarity of what you're doing. But they have to be a specific shape. They have to be in good condition. So you have to keep them like very clean. You have to keep them moisturized, sort of strengthener, because the more you play, the more you wear them down. But it's a bit of a mantra. They have to be at exactly the right angle for where you contact the string. And I have to sit there and I put like nail paper over the string and then actually pluck onto that nail paper across the string. And it gets me exactly the angle at which I make contact. And it's a pretty painstaking process. And I mean, if I break a nail, the air goes blue, you know. Every expletive under the sun comes out my mouth. I never knew I knew these words. You know?
Yeah.
If you break a nail, it's the equivalent of, well, I don't know. It's not just like breaking your bow or something, because you can go and get that rehaired, or you can get a new bow or borrow one for the concert. I mean, you have to put fake nails on, and the contact feels really weird, and it's awful. So your nails are, yeah, we kind of sort of protect them at all costs, you know.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
So talking about the music that you play then, I mean, you play a variety. You play as early as the Renaissance, and then
yep.
the Roland Dienz just died last year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Leo Brouwer, you know,
yeah,
living
yeah.
or contemporary composers. So
absolutely.
is there a specific time period or region that speaks to you maybe more than the others?
Not so much. I mean, I don't play that much 19th century guitar music, certainly, which is kind of, you know, the our sort of heavyweight 19th century composers like Fernando Sor or Mauro Giuliani. I've played it a lot, played it when I was a student a lot. And actually kind of like did enjoy playing it at the time, but I I don't feature it much on my recordings or on my programs at the moment. I might come round to it, but I think with guitar, you're very easily, when you're learning guitar, accepting of all sorts of different eras and genres of music too. And there's quite a nice approach to it. There's nothing snobbish about it. You know, it's like if you're going to play early music on the guitar, you're already playing it on the guitar. Do you know what I mean? So it's not about going to buy gut strings or like, you know, wear tights if you're playing the lute. Do you know what I mean? Like you can just get your guitar out and start to experience that music in like 2017, which it is now. So I love the guitar for that sort of like unashamedly, like we'll play things from all sorts of different eras. You'll go to hear a concert and it's like, you know, 400, 500 years of music might pass you by in that time and you might be able to dip into each of them. The challenge to the performer is to play stylistically well in the different eras, but in a current relevant kind of fashion, you know, not to, like for me, I love going to hear early music groups that specialise in one particular era of music, you know, and I like a lot of the history and the sort of analysis that goes into that. But I remember a great statement from Julian Bream, or a great trick that he had. He used to say, there's hippos at all my concerts. And hippos were historically informed practice police officers, you know? And I mean, he talked about this, I think it's in one of his biographies or the book that was written about him. And it's just hilarious. It's like, you know, well, tell me how it was in 1650 if you were there, or 1750 at the end of Bach's life. Were you there? Do you know what I mean? No, yeah. You weren't, you know. So, and we're in 2017 now. So I love the guitar for that kind of like, it's unashamed. Like I say, it's like, there it is. We just play the music and you can take from it or you can leave. You know, it's up to you, you know, that sort of thing.
How dare you tune it A440 yeah, instead
I mean,
of,
wild,
yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. So you played early music, lute yeah, music, yeah. Music originally written for the lute. So what are some of the challenges that come with adapting that?
Yeah, well, the tunings. I mean, like the Dienz piece I was just in was in a very odd tuning with a very high bass string. So I go even lower now. I go down with the tuning to go to sort of lute music. And you have sort of, with lute, you had many more strings available to you. They're obviously called courses at that time, and a lot of them were doubled strings. And you can do a lot of different things with the tunings. You also have to sort of, if you're playing like Italian lute music or French lute music, or, you know, geographically, the music didn't move around like it does now so easily with internet and with email and things. So styles and tunings sometimes were very specific to the people that were living in a particular area, the particular protagonists at that time, Weiss, Silvius Leopold Weiss in Germany. There were different real, John Dowland, another great composer for lute. So when you approach any of that music, there are quite stark differences between the way they approach certain things. And then, of course, there's naturally going to be some similarities too. So when you're translating that to guitar, you don't have as many strings often, and you certainly quite often don't have as much bass. So you're tuning down to sort of find that bass. And you're being quite creative with the transcriptions. You know, you can't always play exactly what is written, not certainly in the right register. So sometimes you have to sort of invert things or change things around or make very educated guesses at times in some of the manuscripts that you find, you know, that are not really that complete.
So the next couple pieces we're going to hear are your own transcriptions from lute pieces. Can you talk a little bit about the process there?
Absolutely. So we've got a wealth of lute music. Now, when I say lute music, I mean music really recorded on lute in Scotland. We have a lot of what are called lute manuscripts, or essentially like household musical books from the various manor houses and stately homes. The aristocracy had the wealth and they had the money, so they had music as a pastime. Often in some of the big houses in Scotland, they would invite musicians to come and play a lot. And they had working musical manuscript books that they would add to. And a lot of great music was sort of encapsulated in these manuscripts over the centuries, really. And I've looked into some of the greatest hits from those manuscripts, or some of the pieces that are really, really great and worth keeping, I think, in the repertoire. And I mean, I guess for me now, the guitar is the vehicle in which to play them. I wasn't going to sort of retrospectively go back and get a lute and learn them on that, you know. But, you know, people do. I mean, a lot of this music is now getting more and more popular. And we have one estate in Scotland, Balcarres, that has one of the largest collections of lute music anywhere found in Europe. You know, it's about 260 pieces for lute, you know, in it. And there'd be French music, there'd be Scottish music, English music, you know. They were sort of keeping everything in their homes so that they could all play it, you know, when they were entertaining or when people were coming. And the books are really fascinating, actually. So.
Yeah. So what are we going to hear? Well, you have to tune. You have to change your tuning a little bit here.
Nearly there, I think.
Yeah, there's two pieces and your own transcriptions of them.
Yeah, so there's the last one is called The Canaries, which is like a fast kind of jig, so like a dance, really. And The Canaries is a tune that you'll probably recognize if you've listened to Renaissance music. It's that the actual thematic idea is... It's prevalent in Spanish music. Gaspar Sanz, great composer over there. And it was a bit like the sort of almost like the Folios de España. It's traveled around this Canaries, this style, this jig. And then the first tune is like almost like a ballad, like a kind of very romantic, very gentle ballad. And it has no title. And I've seen it by a great Scottish lute player. He called it Rona's Tune, which was after his daughter when his daughter was born. I called it Daniel's Tune. It was after my dad, after he passed away, actually. I sort of dedicated my transcription and sort of arrangement to him. And there's a bit of scope for not improvising, but realizing the bass and the harmony in different ways, because in the first one especially, there was not very much harmony written down. So we were just kind of left to do what you kind of want, to realize the melody. So it's quite fun. So Daniel's Tune and then The Canaries.
Thank you.
guitarist Matthew McAllister performing his own transcriptions of two Scottish lute pieces. The first is an untitled tune that he calls Daniel's Tune, and the second is called Canaries. Matthew McAllister, thank you so much for joining us in Studio A here at Interlaken Public Radio. He'll be giving a recital tonight at 7 o'clock in the Dendrinos Chapel and Recital Hall here on the campus of Interlaken. For more information, you can visit tickets.interlaken.org.